We're still working in Chapter 7, Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom. We're coming towards the close of the chapter. Before we go back to the text, this idea of doing right has a particular context and significance for us today. We can say that today is Diwali. Deepavali, which is the row of lights, one of the most important celebrations in the year in India. There's a story behind it which grows and grows over the centuries and becomes richer and more detailed. So to put it simply, there is a dark being whose name is Naraka, Narakasura. Naraka, ironically, is also the name of a region of hell where torment takes place. So Naraka, this Nara, man, going to Naraka indicates, you know, that people, when they behave poorly, get placed in this particular dominion of the lower world. Naraka founds a city called Pragjyotishpura, the city of light in the east, ironically named. He is powerful, skillful. He has received blessings and boons from many divinities and has been promised a long life filled with victories. Among the things that he does is to kidnap and violate the daughter of the divine architect and carry her off to his kingdom. And then he begins to take damsels, wives, apsarasas, goddesses, gandharvas, 16,000 in number, to his kingdom. And he holds them imprisoned there. No asura in history has committed the crimes, the number of crimes, the horrific deeds that this fellow has done. And so a petition is taken to Lord Vishnu that, will you do something about this? And he says, I will. When I come to earth as Krishna, I will do something. So he goes through his boyhood exploits as Krishna and then becomes king of Dwaraka. And he is approached then to come and face down this asura, this titan. So he says, I will. And he goes alone to face all these hordes of anti-divine figures. And he faces the five great commanders who are generals for this dark lord, and he defeats them one after the other. He goes through terrible places where spikes meet him, and he overcomes them. He climbs high rocky mountains. He goes through a river which is red, presumably with blood. And finally, he gets to the outskirts of the city. And he confronts all those inhabitants, and he defeats them, one after the other, until finally the king, Naraka himself, has to come out and face him. And Naraka summons his greatest weapons, and he hurls them at Krishna. And one after the other, Krishna defeats them with his own powers. And finally, he throws a great weapon. Krishna stands and allows it to hit him right in the chest. And it falls as if a floral garland at his feet. And then, before the asura, astonished, can get off another shot, he throws his discus and cuts the fellow in two. End of the story, except that now all those who have been captured, all 16,000 plus goddesses, semi-divine creatures, etc., all come to Krishna and ask that they be married to him. And he consents. He takes back the earrings which have been stolen from the mother of the gods and goddesses, Aditi, and restores them to earth. He then goes about the rest of his life. Again, the demon may have been killed, but his son continues and rules the remainder of the kingdom and faces Krishna and the heroes on the side of the Kauravas in the war, which is pictured in the Mahabharata. Now, it's a simply told story like this, but look at the significance of what it means. An MP pundit has written beautifully about this in his first book, Grace of the Great, which is compiled from articles that he wrote from 1948 to 1950, before Sri Aurobindo withdrew. He would have seen this story as carried forward by MP Pandit. And Panditji points out the significance of these various things. The city itself, the city of light, which has fallen under the sway of darkness. And all of us reflecting age after age can look at the circumstances around us and find comfort in such an idea that a city can be redeemed, that a state can be redeemed and returned to light, to what it really symbolizes. Krishna represents, obviously, you know, the God in us all, who is willing to face the powers of nature which have gone awry, which have been taken away from their soulful drift and direction and placed into the hands of desire and ego. And he faces these beings with grace, with felicity, with force, because all of these, not just peace, not just light, are native to the soul, to the awakened spirit in us. And as he approaches these beings, he subdues them one after the other, alone, unaided. Whether you're surrounded by darkness or not, you are a figure of light, and you hew to the light and go forward with confidence, with the soul's faith that it will succeed. So when Krishna conquers the demon and takes charge of the 16,000 and agrees to marry them, no, this does not symbolize that he went and, you know, ravished all of these virgins. That's nonsense. What it is a restoration of the powers of nature. These goddesses represent thousands and thousands of aspects of the Shakti, of the one divine power that establishes the universe. And what he represents is the consolidation of all of that, congruent in spiritual harmony. So force restores light. And this is an occasion that symbolizes the victory of light over dark, just as the Pandavas defeat the Kauravas, just as the Devi defeats Mahishasura. Again and again, we go through this cyclic process where darkness rises, light has to come, find itself, and reestablish the right direction, because there is a direction. There is a place that the universe is going. It is following out in the words of Vedanta, the Sanatana Dharma, the eternal path, the eternal way. We must not lose sight of, we must stick to that path, whatever we do. And in fact, tonight, of course, we'll be talking about Dharma from the root DHR with the dot under it, which means to hold firm, to stick to it. It is our real nature. So I think today we celebrate, and to try to ask those who wield the power to go out and do good, the sisters will tie a thread around the wrists of their brothers, who then have to become Krishna and go out and behave felicitously in the world. So, all men, rise to the occasion. So we're on page 201 in the Collected Works of Sri Aurobindo, edition of the Synthesis of Yoga, Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom. The fact is that when we have reached the cult of absolute ethical qualities and erected the categorical imperative of an ideal law, we have not come to the end of our search or touched the truth that delivers. Absolute ethical qualities and categorical imperative obviously refer back to Immanuel Kant, who was dissatisfied with the way morality was understood, the situational ethics of his time, and demanded that if there is going to be a moral law, that it be an imperative of reason, that you must declare an action to be good and necessary. And if it is good and necessary, it should apply at all times universally. Now, this was his idea of what is a categorical imperative. Categorical means unqualified, unconditional. It is a demand of the nature that you behave according to this. Sri Aurobindo has suggested that such things don't get to the truth. They have not touched the truth that delivers. They are born from the mind. And he continues, there is no doubt something here that helps us to rise beyond limitation by the physical and vital man in us, an insistence that overpasses the individual and collective needs and desires of a humanity still bound to the living mud of matter in which it took its roots, an aspiration that helps to develop the mental and moral being in us. This new sublimating element has been, therefore, an acquisition of great importance. Its workings have marked a considerable step forward in the difficult evolution of terrestrial nature. So he's continuing his notation about how law of conduct should govern the individual, how it should govern the collective. But here, a new sublimating and exalting element is brought into the picture. And behind the inadequacy of these ethical conceptions, something too is concealed that does attach to a supreme truth. There is here the glimmer of a light and power that are part of a yet unreached divine nature. But the mental idea of these things is not that light, and the moral formulation of them is not that power. These are only representative constructions of the mind that cannot embody the divine spirit which they vainly endeavor to imprison in their categorical formulas. Beyond the mental and moral being in us is a greater divine being that is spiritual and supramental, for it is only through a large spiritual plane where the mind's formulas dissolve in a white flame of direct inner experience that we can reach beyond mind and pass from its constructions to the vastness and freedom of the supramental realities. So these cannot be equated. Spiritual and supramental are still different. Through the spiritual consciousness, one passes into a zone of awareness of the singularity of the unique and absolute spirit. But that is not the supramental. One must pass beyond that experience of the absolute, in a sense, of the Brahman as it is commonly understood, to reach to the supramental realities. And he also refers here to a white flame of direct inner experience. Remember the flame that he's imaged so successfully in the earlier chapters about the ascent of the sacrifice. This is Agni, the power of the Godhead within us, born from the sun, the supramental sun, residing inside of us as the flame force of our souls. And that is what carries us into and then beyond this white spiritual silence which we call the spirit. It's the image of the sacrificial flame. He continues, there alone can we touch the harmony of the divine powers that are poorly misrepresented to our mind or framed into a false figure by the conflicting or wavering elements of the moral law. There alone, the unification of the transformed vital and physical and the illumined mental man becomes possible in that supramental spirit, which is at once the secret source and goal of our mind and life and body. Again, referring to the metaphysics of the Gita, the supreme spirit, the supreme person, named as Purushottama, the ultimate person, has a supreme nature, para prakriti. That supreme person manifests endlessly, ray after ray from its sun, spark after spark from its fire, of the Jiva Bhuta, all those beings who, in a sense, represent the spark of the eternal spirit, the truth of the individuality. Each spark a member of all the sparks, each spark part of para-prakriti, of that supreme nature. So, when there is a lower nature that comes into being, and those jiva-bhutas, all of them in a sense, populate that sphere down here, that secret nature is part of what they bring, what we bring. So, the secret source and goal of our mind and life and body. So that secret nature, the jiva, which is in us, is always present and in a sense guiding. There alone is there any possibility of an absolute justice, love, and right, far other than that which we imagine at one with each other in the light of a supreme divine knowledge. There alone can there be a reconciliation of the conflict between our members, because we have to ascend back to the nature of the jiva above to recover mastery over the nature here. We have to complete the connection. We're meant to be the bridge, the conscious bridge that brings that here, takes this there. So he means to say that all lower nature comes from and also hides the higher nature. They must be rejoined. They must be reconnected. So alone in that supramental light, where diversity begins but never loses oneness, there alone can there be a reconciliation of the conflict between our members. We're at war here, each against the other, body against mind, life against body, etc., etc. But if we bring in the reconciling element of the supramental harmony, all is satisfied. All become content in a larger oneness. In other words, there is, above society's external law and man's moral law, and beyond them, though feebly and ignorantly aimed at by something within them, a larger truth of a vast unbound consciousness, a law divine towards which both these blind and gross formulations are progressive faltering steps that try to escape from the natural law of the animal to a more exalted light or universal rule. That divine standard, since the Godhead in us is our spirit moving towards its own concealed perfection, must be a supreme spiritual law and truth of our nature. Again, as we are embodied beings in the world with a common existence and nature, and yet individual souls capable of direct touch with the transcendent, this supreme truth of ourselves must have a double character. It must be a law and truth that discovers the perfect movement, harmony, rhythm of a great spiritualized collective life, and determines perfectly our relations with each being and all beings in nature's varied oneness. It must be, at the same time, a law and truth that discovers to us at each moment the rhythm and exact steps of the direct expression of the divine in the soul, mind, life, body of the individual creature. So, the soul of the collective and the soul of the individual at one and in harmony. There's a footnote. Therefore, the Gita defines dharma, an expression which means more than either religion or morality, as action controlled by our essential manner of self-being. Remember, dharma is the law that holds firm to the truth. The essential manner of self-being is swabhava, your own being. So the jiva, remember our transcendent origin above, the transcendent source of individuality is the swabhava. How it expresses itself in the jiva here is through your soul nature and through its natural form in your swadharma, your own nature. So jiva, swabhava, swadharma, expressively moving outwards, you see? And we find in experience that this supreme light and force of action in its highest expression is at once an imperative law and an absolute freedom. It is an imperative law because it governs by immutable truth our every inner and outer movement. And yet at each moment and in each movement of the absolute freedom of the Supreme handles the perfect plasticity of our conscious and liberated nature. Here, of course, the erasure of the ego, the dividing, dislocating ego is presumed. So he's talking about a very exalted state, yes. The ethical idealist tries to discover this supreme law in his own moral data, in the inferior powers and factors that belong to the mental and ethical formula. And to sustain and organize them, he selects a fundamental principle of conduct, essentially unsound and constructed by the intellect, utility, hedonism, reason, intuitive conscience, or any other generalized standard, running helter-skelter through Hobbes, Kant, Spinoza, the rest. So you see, there's a supra-rational, something beyond the mind, a law of our being which is in accord with truth, and then the mental similitude of it, not the same thing, doesn't achieve it, grasps and grabs a fraction of the real being. All such efforts are foredoomed to failure. Our inner nature is the progressive expression of the eternal spirit and too complex a power to be tied down by a single dominant mental or moral principle. Only the supramental consciousness can reveal to its differing and conflicting forces their spiritual truth and harmonize their divergences. The its here can reveal to its differing and conflicting forces, that's the inner nature. So to harmonize all of this completely, yes, you must complete the ascent. The later religions endeavor to fix the type of a supreme truth of conduct, erect a system, and declare God's law through the mouth of avatar or prophet. These systems, more powerful and dynamic than the dry ethical idea, are yet, for the most part, no more than idealistic glorifications of the moral principle sanctified by religious emotion and the label of a superhuman origin. Counterfeit. Some, like the extreme Christian ethic, are rejected by nature because they insist unworkably on an impracticable absolute rule. This God versus nature, the dualism that so marks theistic religions. Others prove in the end to be evolutionary compromises and become obsolete in the march of time. The true divine law, unlike these mental counterfeits, cannot be a system of rigid ethical determinations that press into their cast iron molds all our life movements. The law divine is truth of life and truth of the spirit, and must take up with a free living plasticity and inspire with the direct touch of its eternal light each step of our action and all the complexity of our life issues. It must act not as a rule and formula, but as an enveloping and penetrating conscious presence that determines all our thoughts, activities, feelings, impulsions of will by its infallible power and knowledge. So this is something that arises as a spontaneous law. It is not subject to ratiocination. You do not have to derive a system through logical consistency and say this must be for all in all climes. It is not born of the mind, is not systematized by the mind. Instead, is in the moment of eternity and stands forward as a dynamic truth and power of that eternal consciousness. The older religions erected their rule of the wise, their dicta of Manu or Confucius, a complex shastra in which they attempted to combine the social rule and moral law with the declaration of certain eternal principles of our higher nature in some kind of uniting amalgam. All three were treated on the same ground as equally the expression of everlasting verities, Sanatana Dharma. But two of these elements, social rule, moral law, are evolutionary and valid for a time, mental constructions, human readings of the will of the eternal. The third, attached and subdued to certain social and moral formulas, had to share the fortunes of its forms. Either the shastra grows obsolete and has to be progressively changed or finally cast away, or else it stands as a rigid barrier to the self-development of the individual and the race. The shastra erects a collective and external standard. It ignores the inner nature of the individual, the indeterminable elements of a secret spiritual force within him. But the nature of the individual will not be ignored. Its demand is inexorable. The nature of the individual, the Jiva Bhuta, whose nature is the Swabhava, Bhagavad Gita 7.5. The unrestrained indulgence of his outer impulses leads to anarchy and dissolution. But the suppression and coercion of his soul's freedom by a fixed and mechanical rule spells stagnation or an inner death. Not this coercion or determination from outside, but the free discovery of his highest spirit and the truth of an eternal movement is the supreme thing that he has to discover. The higher ethical law is discovered by the individual in his mind and will and psychic sense, and then extended to the race. The supreme law also must be discovered by the individual in his spirit. Then only, through a spiritual influence and not by the mental idea, can it be extended to others. A moral law can be imposed as a rule or an ideal on numbers of men who have not attained that level of consciousness or that fineness of mind and will and psychic sense in which it can become a reality to them and a living force. As an ideal, it can be revered without any need of practice. As a rule, it can be observed in its outsides, even if the inner sense is missed altogether. The supramental and spiritual life cannot be mechanized in this way. It cannot be turned into a mental ideal or an external rule. It has its own great lines, but these must be made real, must be the workings of an active power felt in the individual's consciousness, and the transcriptions of an eternal truth powerful to transform mind, life, and body. And because it is thus real, effective, imperative, the generalization of the supramental consciousness and the spiritual life is the sole force that can lead to individual and collective perfection in Earth's highest creatures. Only by our coming into constant touch with the divine consciousness and its absolute truth can some form of the conscious divine, the dynamic absolute, take up our earth existence and transform its strife stumblings, sufferings, and falsities into an image of the supreme light, power, and Ananda. And this again is resonant with what he wrote in the final chapter of The Mother in its closing paragraphs. The culmination of the soul's constant touch with the Supreme is that self-giving which we call surrender to the divine will and emergence of the separated ego in the one who is all. And this goes back to the Gita, the 18th chapter, the 65th shloka. A vast universality of soul and an intense unity with all is the base and fixed condition of the supramental consciousness and spiritual life. In that universality and unity alone, can we find the supreme law of the divine manifestation in the life of the embodied spirit? In that alone can we discover the supreme motion and right play of our individual nature. In that alone can all these lower discords resolve themselves into a victorious harmony of the true relations between manifested beings who are portions of the one Godhead and children of one universal mother. This again is that spread of verses in the 18th chapter of the Gita, 54 through 56, and culminating, of course, in the 66th shloka. So there's a good place, obviously, to break. And I think since we're calling upon remembrance of our higher nature, we can turn to a section from Savitri that we like to hear from time to time. This is in Book 3, The Book of the Divine Mother, Canto 4, The Vision and the Boon. I saw the omnipotence flaming pioneers over the heavenly verge which turns towards life come crowding down the amber stairs of birth. Forerunners of a divine multitude, out of the paths of the morning star they came into the little room of mortal life. I saw them cross the twilight of an age, the sun-eyed children of a marvelous dawn, the great creators with wide brows of calm, the massive barrier-breakers of the world, and wrestlers with destiny and her lists of will, the laborers and the quarries of the gods, the messengers of the incommunicable, the architects of immortality. Into the fallen human sphere they came, faces that wore the immortal's glory still, voices that communed still with the thoughts of God, bodies made beautiful by the Spirit's light, carrying the magic word, the mystic fire, carrying the Dionysian cup of joy, approaching eyes of a diviner man, lips chanting an unknown anthem of the soul, feet echoing in the corridors of time. High priests of wisdom, sweetness, might, and bliss, discoverers of beauty's sunlit ways, and swimmers of love's laughing fiery floods, and dancers within rapture's golden doors, their tread one day shall change the suffering earth and justify the light on nature's face. Although fate lingers in the high beyond, and the work seems vain on which our heart's force was spent, All shall be done for which our pain was born. Even as of old man came behind the beast, this high divine successor surely shall come behind man's inefficient mortal pace, behind his vain labor, sweat and blood and tears. He shall know what mortal mind barely durst think. He shall do what the heart of the mortal could not dare. Inheritor of the toil of human time, he shall take on him the burden of the gods. All heavenly light shall visit the earth's thoughts. The might of heaven shall fortify earthly hearts. Earth's deeds shall touch the superhuman's height. Earth's seeing widen into the infinite. The rest of the passage we'll read another time. Encouragement enough for one evening. Namaste, Jai Ma.